and clean clothes, the softest, cleanest clothes I'd ever worn. The kitchen floor gleamed and all the bottles had been removed, the worktops wiped down. There was a pile of folded laundry on one of the chairs. The table was bare save for a vase, the only one I owned, filled with yellow tulips. There's a note propped against it. Some food in the fridge. Try to drink as much water as you can. Call me when you're up. R. Kiss. He'd scrawled his phone number at the bottom. I sat down and stared at it, and then at the sunshine brightness of the flowers. No one had ever bought me flowers before. I didn't much care for tulips, but he wasn't to know that. I started to cry. Huge, quivering sobs, howling like an animal. It felt like I would never stop, like I couldn't stop. Eventually, from sheer physical exhaustion, I was quiet. I rested my forehead on the table. My life, I realized, had gone wrong. Very, very wrong. I wasn't supposed to live like this. No one was supposed to live like this. The problem was that I simply didn't know how to make it right. Mummy's way was wrong, I knew that. But no one had ever shown me the right way to live a life. And although I'd tried my best over the years, I simply didn't know how to make things better. I could not solve the puzzle of me. I made some tea and heated up the ready meal that Raymond had left in the fridge. I was, I discovered, very hungry indeed. I washed the cup and fork afterwards, stacked them beside the other clean crockery he'd left to drain. I went into the living room and picked up the phone. He answered on the second ring.
"Eleanor, thank God," he said. "Pause. How are you feeling?"
"Hello, Raymond," I said.
"How are you?"
he asked again, sounding strained. "Fine, thanks," I said. This was, I knew, the correct answer.
"For fuck's sake, Eleanor! Fine! Oh, Christ!" he said. "I'll be round in an hour, okay?"
"Really, Raymond, there's no need," I said calmly. "I've had some food." I didn't know what time it was and didn't want to risk guessing whether it had been lunch or dinner. "And a shower. And I'm going to read for a while and then have an early night."
"I'll be round in an hour," he said again, firmly, and then hung up.
When I answered the door, he was holding a bottle of Iron Brew and a bag of jelly babies. I managed a smile. "Come in," I said. I wondered how he'd got in before. Had no recollection of opening the door to him. What had I said? What kind of state had I been in? I felt my heart start to pound, jittery and anxious. Had I sworn at him? Had I been naked? Had something terrible happened between us? I felt the Iron Brew start to slip from my grasp and it fell on the floor and rolled around. He picked it up, gripped my elbow in his other hand and guided me to the kitchen. He sat me at the table and put the kettle on. I should have been offended that he was commandeering my living space, but instead I felt relief, overwhelming relief at being taken care of. We sat on opposite sides of the table with a cup of tea and said nothing for a while. He spoke first.
"What the fuck, Eleanor?" he said.
I was shocked to hear the wobble in his voice, as though there were tears lurking there. I simply shrugged. He began to look angry.
"Eleanor, you were AWOL from work for 3 days. Bob was really worried about you, we all were. I got your address from him. I came round to see if you're okay and I find you...
"Preparing to kill myself?" I asked. He rubbed his hand across his face and I saw that he was very close to crying.
"Look, I know you're a very private person and that's fine, but we're pals, you know, you can talk to me about stuff. Don't bottle things up."
"Why not?" I asked. "How can telling someone how bad you're feeling make it better? It's not like they can fix it, can they?"
"They probably can't fix everything, Eleanor, no," he said, "but talking can help. Other people have problems too, you know, they understand what it feels like to be unhappy. A problem shared and all that."
"I don't think anyone on earth would understand what it feels like to be me," I said. "That's just a fact. I don't think anyone else has lived through precisely the set of circumstances I've lived through. And survived them, at any rate,"
I said. It was an important clarification.
Try me, he said.
He looked at me and I looked at him.
Okay, if not me, then try someone else, a counsellor, a therapist.
I snorted, a most inelegant sound.
A counsellor, I said. Oh, let's sit around and talk about our feelings and that'll magically make everything better.
I don't think so, Raymond. He smiled.
How will you know until you try, though? What have you got to lose? There's no shame, you know, no shame at all in being depressed or having a mental illness or whatever.
I almost choked on my tea.
Mental illness? What are you talking about, Raymond?
I shook my head. He held up both hands in a placatory movement.
Look, I'm not a doctor. It's just, well, I don't think someone who gives themselves alcohol poisoning while they plan their suicide is, you know, in a very good place.
This was such a ridiculous summation of my situation that I almost laughed. Raymond wasn't usually prone to exaggeration, but this was over the top, and I couldn't allow it to stand as a factually accurate description of what had happened that night.
Raymond, I simply had a bit too much vodka after a stressful evening, that's all. It's hardly symptomatic of an illness.
Where had you been that night? He said.
What's been going on since then?
I shrugged. I went to a gig, I said. It wasn't very good. Neither of us spoke for a while.
Eleanor, he said eventually, this is serious.
If I hadn't come over when I did, you might be dead by now. Either from the booze or from choking on your own vomit. That's if you hadn't already overdosed on the pills or whatever.
I put my head on one side and pondered this. All right, I said. I concede that I was feeling very unhappy. But doesn't everyone feel sad from time to time?
Yes, of course they do, Eleanor, he said calmly. But when people are feeling sad, they have a little cry, maybe eat too much ice cream, stay in bed all afternoon. What they don't do is think about drinking drain cleaner or opening their veins with a bread knife.
Despite myself, I shuddered at the thought of those sharp, sharp teeth. I shrugged, acquiescing.
Touché, Raymond, I said. I can't counter your reasoning.
He reached out and put his hands on my forearms, squeezed them. He was strong.
Will you think about going to the doctor at least? Wouldn't do any harm, would it?
I nodded. Again, he was being logical and you can't argue with logic.
Is there anyone you want me to get in contact with? He said. A friend, a relative. What about your mum? She'll want to know that you've been feeling like this, won't she?
He stopped speaking because I laughed.
Not mummy, I said, shaking my head. She'd probably be absolutely delighted.
Raymond looked horrified.
Come on, Eleanor, that's a terrible thing to say, he said, visibly shocked. No one's mother would be happy to know their child was suffering.
I shrugged and kept my eyes focused on the floor. You haven't met mummy, I said.
Chapter 28. The next few days were somewhat challenging. On several occasions, Raymond arrived unannounced, ostensibly to bring comestibles or relay messages from Bob, but in fact to check that I hadn't committed an act of self-slaughter. If I were to compose a concise crossword clue to describe Raymond's demeanour, it would be the opposite of inscrutable. I could only hope that the man refrained from playing poker on all but the most casual basis, as I feared he'd be leaving the table with an empty wallet. It was surprising that he should bother with me, especially given the unpleasant circumstances in which he'd found me after the concert. Whenever I'd been sad or upset before, the relevant people in my life would simply call my social worker and I'd be moved somewhere else. Raymond hadn't phoned anyone or asked an outside agency to intervene. He'd elected to look after me himself. I'd been pondering this and concluded that there must be some people for whom difficult behaviour wasn't a reason to end their relationship with you. If they liked you, and I remembered Raymond and I had agreed that we were pals now, then it seemed they were prepared to maintain contact,
even if he was sad or upset or behaving in very challenging ways. This was something of a revelation. I wondered if that's what it would be like in a family, if you had parents or a sister, say, who would be there no matter what. It wasn't that you could take them for granted as such. Heaven knows, nothing can be taken for granted in this life. It was simply that you would know, almost unthinkingly, that they'd be there if you needed them, no matter how bad things got. I'm not prone to envy, as a rule, but I must confess I felt a twinge when I thought about this. Envy was a minor emotion, however, in comparison to the sorrow I felt at never having a chance to experience this, what was it? Unconditional love, I supposed. But there was no use in crying over spilt milk. Raymond had shown me a little of what it must be like, and I counted myself lucky to have had the opportunity. Today he'd arrived with a box of after-eight mints and, improbably, a helium-filled balloon.
"I know it's daft," he said, smiling, "but I was passing the market in the square and I saw a guy selling these when I was going for my bus. Thought it might cheer you up."
I saw what he was holding and I laughed, an unexpected burst of feeling, unfamiliar. He passed me the ribbon and the balloon soared towards my low ceiling, then bobbed against it, as though it was trying to escape.
"What is it supposed to be?" I said.
Is it cheese?" I had never been given a helium balloon before, and certainly not one this odd-looking.
"It's SpongeBob, Eleanor," he said, speaking very slowly and clearly as though I was some sort of idiot. "SpongeBob SquarePants?"
A semi-human bath sponge with protruding front teeth, on sale as if it was something completely unremarkable. For my entire life, people have said that I'm strange, but really, when I see things like this, I realise that I'm actually relatively normal. I made tea for us. Raymond had put his feet up on the coffee table. I was considering asking him to remove them, but then the thought came to me that he must feel at home in my house, comfortable enough to relax here and make full use of the furniture. The idea was actually rather pleasing. He slurped his tea, a much less pleasant intrusion, and asked about the GP. Earlier in the week, after Raymond had delivered a persuasive argument about the importance of obtaining an expert, objective view of my emotional state, and of the efficacy of modern treatments should any mental health issues be diagnosed, I'd finally agreed to make an appointment at the surgery. "I'm going tomorrow," I said, "11:30. He nodded.
"That's good, Eleanor," he said. "Now promise me you'll be completely honest with the doctor. Tell her exactly what you've been feeling, what you've been going through."
I thought about this. I would tell her almost everything, I decided, but I wasn't going to mention the little stockpile of pills, which no longer existed in any case. Raymond had, with scant concern for the environment, flushed them down the lavatory. I'd professed irritation, but was secretly glad to be rid of them. And I'd also decided to say nothing about the chats with Mummy, or our ridiculous abortive project. Mummy always said that information should be divulged to professional busybodies on a need-to-know basis, and these topics weren't relevant. All the doctor needed to understand was that I was very unhappy, so that she could advise me how best to go about changing that. He didn't need to start digging around in the past, talking about things that couldn't be changed. "Promise," I said. I had my fingers crossed, though. Chapter 29. When the GP signed me off work, I wondered how a life of indolence would suit me. I've always had a full-time job, having started with Bob the week after I received my degree, and in all the years since then I've never once had cause to call in sick. Fortunately, I've been blessed with an extremely robust constitution. The first week, the week immediately after the incident with the vodka and a visit from Raymond, I slept a lot. I must have done other things, normal things too, like going out to buy milk or having a shower, but I can't recall them now. The doctor had somehow managed to deduce that I was suffering from depression, even with only a few scant details to go on. I managed to keep all of my most important secrets to myself. She suggested that medication and talking therapy combined was the most effective form of treatment, but I insisted that I did not wish to take any tablets, at least initially. I was worried that I might start to rely on them in the same way that I'd been relying on vodka. I did, however, reluctantly agree to see a counsellor as a first step, and the inaugural session had been scheduled for today. I had been assigned to a Maria Temple, no title provided. I cared nothing for her marital status, but it would have been helpful to know in advance whether or not she was in possession of any formal medical qualifications. Her office was located on the third floor of a tall, modern block in the city centre. The lift had transported me back in time to that least belle of époque, the 1980s. Grey, grey, grey. Sludgy pastels, dirty plastic, nasty carpets. It smelled like it hadn't been cleaned since the 1980s either. I had been reluctant to attend the counselling session from the outset, and to do so in this setting made it even less enticing, if such a thing were possible. Sadly, the environment was all too familiar, and this was, in its own way, a comfort. The institutional corridors with floral friezes and artex ceilings down which I have walked in my life are legion. I knocked on the door. Thin plywood, grey, no nameplate. And, too quickly, as though she had been standing right behind it, Maria Temple opened it and invited me in. The room was tiny. A dining chair and two institutional armchairs, the wipe-clean, uncomfortable kind, arranged opposite a small, low table, on which was placed a box of non-branded, man-sized tissues. I was momentarily thrown. Their noses are, with a few exceptions, more or less the same size as our own, are they not? Did they really need a vastly bigger surface area of tissue simply because they were in possession of an XY chromosome? Why? I suspected that I really did not want to know the answer to that question. There was no window, and a framed print on the wall, a vase of roses made using a computer by someone who was dead inside, was more offensive to the eye than a bare wall. "You must be Eleanor," she said, smiling. "It's Miss Oliphant, actually," I said, taking off my jerkin and wondering what on earth to do with it. She pointed to a row of hooks on the back of the door where I placed it as far away as possible from the very practical waterproof which hung there already. I sat down opposite her. The chair released a tired whump of stale air from its grubby cushions. She smiled at me. Her teeth! Oh, Miss Temple, she had done her best, but nothing could change the size of them, I supposed. They belonged in a far bigger mouth, perhaps not even a human one. I was reminded of a photograph that the Telegraph had featured some time ago, of a monkey which had grabbed a camera and taken its own grinning photograph, a selfie. The poor woman. An adjective which one would never wish to have applied to one's teeth was simian. "I'm Maria Temple, Eleanor, Miss Oliphant," she said. "It's a pleasure to meet you." She looked intently at me, which made me sit forward in my seat, not wanting to show how uncomfortable I was feeling. "Have you ever had counselling before, Miss Oliphant?" she said, taking out a notebook from her handbag. It had, I noticed, several accessories attached to it, key rings and the like, a pink fluffy monkey, a giant metallic letter M, and, most hideous of all, a tiny sequined red stiletto shoe. I'd come across the type before. Miss Temple was fun. "Yes and no," I said. She raised a quizzical eyebrow, but I declined to elaborate further. There was a silence in which I heard the lift clattering again, although no further sound or evidence of human occupation followed. I felt marooned. "Okay, then," she said brightly, too brightly. "I think we'll get started. Now, first of all, I want to reassure you that everything we discuss in here together is absolutely confidential. I'm a member of all the relevant professional bodies, and we adhere to a very strict code of conduct. You should always feel comfortable and safe in this space, and please ask me anything at any time. especially if you're not clear about what we're doing or why." She seemed to be waiting for some sort of response, but I had none to offer her. I shrugged. She settled into her chair and began reading from her notebook. "You've been referred here by your GP, I see, and you've been suffering from depression," I nodded. "Can you tell me a bit about how you've been feeling?" she said. Her smile had assumed a slightly fixed quality. "I've been feeling a bit sad, I suppose," I said. I stared at her shoes. They resembled golf shoes, only without spikes. They were gold. Unbelievable. "How long have you been feeling sad, Miss Oliphant?" She tapped her enormous teeth with her pen. "Actually, would you mind if I called you Eleanor? It would just, you know, help the discussion flow a bit more freely if we were both on first name terms, I think. Would that be okay?" She smiled. "I prefer Miss Oliphant, but yes, I suppose so," I said graciously. Titles were better, though. I didn't know her from Adam, after all. She wasn't my friend. She was someone who was being paid to interact with me. A bit of professional distance is highly appropriate, I feel, when, for example, a stranger is examining the back of your eyeballs for tumours or rooting around in your dentine with a hooked instrument. Or indeed, poking around in your brain, dragging out your feelings and letting them sit there in the room in all their shameful awfulness. "Great," she said brightly, and I could tell that she had realised I was most decidedly not fun. We wouldn't ever be going bungee jumping or to a fancy dress party together. "What else is supposed to be fun? Sing-alongs, sponsored runs, magicians? I've no idea. Personally, I like animals and crosswords and, until very recently, vodka. What could be more fun than that? Not belly dancing classes in the community hall. Not murder mystery weekends. Hindus? No." "Was there something in particular that led you to seek help from your GP?" she said. "An incident? An interaction? Telling someone how you're feeling can be a very difficult thing to do, but it's great that you took such an important first step." "A friend suggested that I see my doctor," I said, experiencing a tiny frisson of pleasure as I used the F-word. "Raymond," I clarified. I rather liked saying his name, the rhotic trill at the start. It was a nice name, a good name, and that at least seemed fair. He deserved some luck. After all, given his meagre physical blessings, he already had enough to contend with, without being lumbered with, say, Eustace or Tyson as a first name. "Would you like to tell me about the events leading up to your decision to visit your GP? What prompted your friend to make the suggestion?" she said. "How were you feeling then?" "I was feeling a bit sad and things got on top of me, that's all. So my friend suggested that I should see my GP, and the GP said I had to come here if I didn't want to take the pills." She looked intently at me. "Could you tell me why you were feeling sad?" she said. I released a sigh that was longer and more unintentionally histrionic than I had been expecting. I felt my throat constrict at the end of the breath, tightening with tears. "Don't cry, Eleanor. Do not cry in front of the stranger." "It's quite boring," I said, trying my best to sound nonchalant. "It was just sort of love affair that went wrong, that's all. A perfectly standard situation." There was a lengthy silence. Eventually, purely to try and get this over with as quickly as possible, I spoke again. "There was a misunderstanding. I thought I misinterpreted some signals. It turned out that I had very much got the wrong impression of the person concerned." "Has this happened to you before?" she asked quietly. "No," I said. There was another lengthy silence. "Who was this person, Eleanor? Can you talk a bit more about what happened to make you, how did you put it, misunderstand the signals? What were the signals?" "Well, there was a man that I took a bit of a liking to, a little crush, you might say, and I got slightly carried away, and then I realised that actually I'd been a bit silly. We weren't going to be together. And he, well, it turned out that he wasn't even right for me anyway. He wasn't the man I thought he was. I felt sad about that, and I felt extremely stupid for getting it all so wrong. That's all it was. I heard my voice trail off. Okay, well, there are a few things I'd like to unpick in all of that. How did you meet this man? What was the nature of your relationship with him? Oh, I never actually met him, I said. She stopped writing in her notebook, and there was a bit of an awkward pause. I think, in theatrical terms, it's called a beat. Right, she said. So how did your paths cross, then? He's a musician. I saw him perform, and, well, I fell for him, I suppose you'd say. Maria Temple spoke cautiously. Is he famous? I shook my head. He's local. He lives here. Near me, in fact. He's not famous as such. Yet. Maria Temple said nothing and waited for me to continue. She didn't even raise an eyebrow. Nothing. I realised that I may have given her a slightly misleading impression of my behaviour. To be clear, I said, I'm not some sort of stalker. I merely found out where he lives and I copied out a poem for him, which I didn't even send, and I tweeted him once, but that's all. That's not a crime. All the information I needed was in the public domain. I didn't break any laws or anything like that. And you've never found yourself in this sort of situation before, Eleanor, with anyone else? So she thought I might be some sort of obsessive, serially fixated on strangers. Charming. No, never, I said, firmly and truthfully. He was just... He caught my eye, piqued my interest, that's all. He was, you know, handsome. There was another long pause. Finally, Maria Temple sat back in her chair and began to speak, which was a relief. It was exhausting answering all these questions, talking about myself and worrying whether I sounded as stupid, as embarrassingly naive as I thought I did. Here's a scenario. I'll run it by you and you can see what you think. Let's say, for the sake of argument, Eleanor, that you had developed a crush on this man. These sorts of feelings are generally a sort of emotional trial run for a real relationship. They're very intense. Does that sound reasonable, plausible so far? I stared at her. So, she went on, there you were, quite enjoying your crush, feeling the feelings. Tell me, what happened to bring this to an end all of a sudden? What crushed the crush, as it were? I slumped back into my seat. She had taken me by surprise with her startlingly accurate summary of how things had been, and then asked a very interesting, pertinent question. Despite the gold shoes and the novelty key rings, I could see already that Maria Temple was no fool. This was all going to take me a while to process, but in the meantime I tried to gather my thoughts into some sort of coherent response. I suppose on some level I actually felt the whole thing was real, and that when we finally met we'd fall in love and get married and so on. I felt, I don't know, somehow ready for a relationship like that. People, men like him, don't cross my path very often. It seemed only right not to let the opportunity pass by, and I felt sure that certain people would be pleased that I found him. When he and I were finally in the same room together, though, something that I'd worked hard to make happen, the whole thing just sort of dissolved. Does that make any sense? She nodded encouragingly. I suppose I realised right there in that room that I'd been stupid, acting like a teenager rather than a 30-year-old woman. He wasn't even special. I'd been focused on him, but really it could have been anyone. I'd been trying to please him. Nodding, she interrupted me, thankfully stopping me from going too far. There are actually quite a number of issues I'd like to suggest we explore over the next few sessions, she said. We've been talking about recent events here today, but at some point I'd like to hear a bit about your childhood.
Absolutely not, I said, folding my arms and staring at the carpet.
The lady does not need to know what goes on in this house.
I understand that it can be a very difficult thing to talk about, she said.
I don't want to talk about any of that, Maria. Please do not ask me to talk about Mummy.
Damn, 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 she leapt on that, of course. Mummy's always the star turn, the big draw.
What sort of relationship do you have with your mother, Eleanor? Are you close?
Mummy's in contact quite regularly.
Too regularly, I said.
The cat was out of the bag now.
You two don't get on then, she said.
It's complicated.
I noticed myself physically as well as metaphorically squirming in my seat.
Can you tell me why?
Maria asked, bold as brass, nosy, intrusive, shameless.
No, I said.
There was a very long pause. I know that it's difficult, really difficult, to talk about painful things, but as I said, that's the best route to helping us move forward.
Let's start very slowly. Can you tell me why you don't feel comfortable talking about your mother?
She wouldn't want me to, I said.
That was true. I remember the last and only time I'd done it with a teacher. It wasn't a mistake you made twice.
My left leg had begun to tremble, just a little quiver, but once it started I couldn't get it to stop. I threw my head back and made a noise, a sort of sigh mixed with a cough to try to distract her eye from it.
Okay, she said patiently. If it's all right with you to finish up, I'd like to suggest that we try something a bit different. It's called the empty chair exercise, she said.
I folded my arms and stared at her.
Basically, I'd like you to imagine that this chair here, she indicated the lone upright dining chair, is your mother.
She anticipated my response. Now, I know this might feel silly or embarrassing, but please just try and go with it. No one's judging you here. This is a safe space.
I twisted my hands together anxiously in my lap, mirroring the feeling in my stomach.
Are you willing to give it a try?
I stared at the door, willing myself out of it and willing the hands of the clock to tick round to the hour.
Eleanor, she said gently, I'm here to help you and you're here to help yourself, aren't you?
I think you want to be happy. In fact, I know you do. Who doesn't?
We can work together in this room towards helping you achieve that. It's not going to be easy or quick, but I really think it could be worth it.
What have you got to lose, after all?
You're going to be here for an hour either way. Why not give it a try?
She'd made a fair point, I supposed.
I looked up and slowly unfolded my arms.
Great, she said. Thank you, Eleanor. So, let's imagine that this chair here is your mother. What do you want to tell her right now? If you could say anything right here without being interrupted, without fear of judgment.
Come on, don't worry. Anything you like.
I turned to face the empty chair. My leg was still trembling. I cleared my throat. I was safe. She wasn't really here, she wasn't really listening. I thought back to that house, the cold, the damp smell, the wallpaper with the cornflowers and the brown carpet. I heard the cars passing by outside, all of them driving to nice places, safe places, while we were here, left all alone or, worse, left with her.
Mummy, please,
I said. I could hear my voice outside of my own head, disembodied in the room, floating. It was high and very, very quiet. I breathed in.
Please don't hurt us.
Chapter 30.
I don't resort to foul language as a rule, but that first session with the counsellor yesterday was bloody ridiculous. I started crying in front of Dr. Temple at the end of her stupid empty chair exercise.
and then she actually said with faux gentleness that our session had to draw to a close and that she'd see me next week at the same time. She basically hustled me out onto the street, and I found myself standing on the pavement, shoppers bustling past me, tears streaming down my face. How could she do it? How could one human being see another so obviously in pain, a pain she had deliberately drawn out and worried away at, and then push her out onto the street and leave her to cope with it alone? It was 11 a.m. I wasn't supposed to be drinking, but I wiped away my tears, went into the nearest pub and ordered a large vodka. I silently raised a toast to absent friends and drank it down fast. I walked out before any of the daytime drinkers could begin an interaction with me. Then I went home and got into bed. Raymond and I continued to meet for lunch in our usual cafe while I was off work. He would text me to suggest a time and date, the only texts I had received on my new mobile telephone so far. It turned out that if you saw the same person with some degree of regularity, then the conversation was immediately pleasant and comfortable. You could pick up where you left off, as it were, rather than having to start afresh each time. During the course of these chats, Raymond asked again about Mummy, why I hadn't told her I'd been unwell, why she never visited me or I her, until finally I gave in and provided him with a potted biography. He already knew about the fire, of course, and that I'd been brought up in care afterwards. That, I told him, was because it wasn't possible for me to live with Mummy afterwards, not where she was. It was, I'd hoped, enough to keep him quiet, but no. "Where is she, then? In a hospital or nursing home?" he guessed. I shook my head. "It's a bad place for bad people," I said. He thought for a moment.
"Not prison?"
He looked shocked. I held his gaze but said nothing. After another short pause, he asked, not unreasonably, what crime she had committed. "I can't remember," I said. He stared at me, then snorted.
"Bullshit," he said. "Come on, Eleanor, you can tell me. It won't change anything between us, I promise. It's not like you did it, whatever it was."
I felt a hot flush streak right up the front of my body and then down my back, a sensation I can only liken to being given a sedative prior to a general anaesthetic. My pulse was pounding. "It's true," I said. "I honestly don't know. I think I must have been told at the time, but I can't remember. I was only 10. Everyone was really careful never to mention it around me."
"Oh, come on," he said. "She must have done something really terrible to... I mean, what about at school? Kids can be little shits about stuff like that. What about when people hear your name? Although, come to think of it, I don't think I remember reading anything about a crime involving an oliphant."
"Yes, I suppose you would have remembered an oliphant in the room," I said. He didn't laugh. It wasn't a very good joke, on reflection. I cleared my throat. "Oliphant isn't my real name," I said. "I liked it, always had, and was extremely grateful to whoever had selected it for me. You didn't come across many oliphants, that was for sure. Special." He stared at me, like he was watching a film. "They gave me a new identity afterwards, moved me up here. It was meant to stop people recognizing me, protect me, which is ironic."
"Why?" he said.
I sighed. "Being in care wasn't always much fun. I mean, it was completely fine, I had everything I needed, but it wasn't all picnics and pillow fights." He raised his eyebrows, nodded. I stirred my coffee. "The terminology's different now, I think," I said. "They call young people in care looked after, but every child should be looked after. It really ought to be the default." I heard myself sounding angry and sad. No one likes hearing themselves sound like that. If someone said, "Please could you describe yourself in 2 words, and you said, let me see, angry and sad, then that really wouldn't be good. Raymond had reached out then, and very gently he squeezed my shoulder. It was superficially ineffectual, but in fact felt surprisingly pleasant.
"Do you want me to find out what she did?" he said. "I bet I could, quite easily. The magic of the interweb, eh?"
"No, thank you," I said curtly. I'm more than capable of finding out myself, should I ever wish to. You're not the only person who knows how to use a computer, you know, I said. His face went very pink. And in any case, I went on, as you so thoughtfully pointed out, it must have been something fairly horrendous. Don't forget I still have to talk to her once a week, as hard enough as it is. It will be completely impossible if I know that she's done... whatever it is that she's done. Raymond nodded. To his credit, he looked slightly ashamed and only a tiny bit disappointed. He really isn't prurient, unlike most other people. After this chat, he still asked questions, but they were normal questions that anyone would ask about their friend's mother. Friend. I've got a friend. How she was, whether we'd spoken recently. I asked him the same questions back. It was normal. I didn't tell him most of what Mummy said during our chats, of course. It was too painful to repeat, embarrassing and humiliating. I was sure Raymond was already acutely aware of my many physical and character defects, and so there was no need to remind him of them by relating Mummy's bon mot. Sometimes he made me stop and think. We'd been talking about holidays, how he planned to go travelling when he retired, so that he would have enough money to do it in style. Mummy's seen so much of the world, lived in so many different places, I said. I reeled a few off. Raymond, surprisingly, looked distinctly unimpressed.
How old is your mum? He said.
I was taken aback. How old was she? I started to work it out. So, well, I'm 30, and I think she must have had me when she was very young. 19 or 20? So she'll be... I guess she'd be in her early 50s now, something like that. Raymond nodded.
Right, he said. So I'm wondering, I mean, I don't have kids, so what would I know, but I imagine it can't be easy lodging in an opium den in Tangier if you've got a toddler with you. Or, what's the other thing? Working as a blackjack dealer in Macau?
He spoke very gently, as though he were afraid to upset me.
I mean, if you added up all the things she said she'd done, wouldn't it cover a longer period than 30 years? Unless she did it all before you were born and she was still a teenager. And if she did, well, I'm wondering, where did she get the money from to do all that travelling, and wasn't she a bit young to be going to places like that on her own at that age? What about your dad? Where did she meet him?
I looked away. These were important questions that I couldn't answer. Questions I wasn't sure I wanted to answer. But really, why hadn't I ever thought about them before? This conversation with Raymond came back to me the next time I spoke to her. "Hello, darling," she said. I thought I heard a hiss of static, or perhaps the malign buzz of strip lighting, and another noise. Something that sounded a bit like the clanging of bolts being drawn. "Hello, Mummy," I whispered. I could hear chewing. "Are you eating?" I said. She exhaled, and then there was an awful honking sound like a cat trying to cough up a furball, followed by a moist splat. "Chewing tobacco," she said dismissively. "Ghastly stuff. I'd advise against it, darling."
"Mummy, I'm hardly likely to try chewing tobacco, am I?"
"I suppose not," she said. "You never were very adventurous."
"Don't knock it till you've tried it, though."
"I indulged in some pawn now and again, back when I lived in Lahore. As I told Raymond, Mummy has lived in Mumbai, Tashkent, Sao Paulo and Taipei. She's trekked in the Sarawak jungle and climbed Mount Toubkal. She's had an audience with the Dalai Lama in Kathmandu and taken afternoon tea with the Maharaja in Jaipur. And that's just for starters." There was some more throat clearing. The chewing tobacco had clearly taken its toll. I took advantage of the opening.
"Mummy, I wanted to ask you something. How old were you when you had me?"
She laughed, unamused.
"I was 13. No, wait. I was 49.
"Whatever. Why do you care? What's it to you, daughter mine?"
"I was just wondering," I said.
She sighed. I have actually told you all this before, Eleanor, she said briskly. I do wish that you would listen. There was a pause.
I was 20, she said calmly. From an evolutionary point of view, that's actually the peak time for a woman to give birth, you know. Everything just springs back into place. Why, even now I still have the pert, firm breasts of an early career supermodel. Mummy, please, I said. She cackled. What's wrong, Eleanor? Am I embarrassing you? What a strange child you are. You always were. Hard to love. That's what you are. Very hard to love. Her laughter trailed off into a long, painful-sounding cough.
Christ, she said. I'm starting to fall apart.
For the first time I could remember, I heard a note of sadness in her voice.
Aren't you well, Mummy? I asked.
She sighed.
Oh, I'm fine, Eleanor, she said. Talking to you always revitalizes me.
I looked at the wall, waiting for the onslaught. I could almost feel her gathering herself, ready to strike.
All alone, aren't you? No one to talk to, no one to play with, and it's all your own fault. Strange, sad little Eleanor. Too bright for your own good, aren't you? You always were. And yet, in so many ways, you're incredibly spectacularly stupid. You can't see what's right in front of your nose. Or should I say, who?
She coughed again. I did not dare to breathe, waiting for what would come next.
Oh, I'm so, so tired of talking.
It's your turn, Eleanor. If you had even a modicum of social savoir-faire, you'd know that conversation is supposed to be a to and fro, a game of verbal tennis. Don't you remember me teaching you that? So come on, tell me, what have you been doing this week?
I said nothing. I wasn't sure I'd be able to speak.
I must say, she went on, I was surprised when you told me you'd been promoted at work. You've always been more of a follower than a leader, haven't you, darling?
Should I tell her that I'd been signed off sick? I had managed to avoid any talk of work recently, but she'd raised the topic now. Did she already know about my absence? And was this, therefore, a trap?
I tried to think on my feet, but that's something I've never been good at. Too slow, Eleanor. Too late.
Mummy, I've been unwell. I'm off work at the moment. I'm on sick leave for a while.
I heard a deep breath. Was she shocked, concerned? The same breath rushed out of her down the phone and into my ear, heavy and fast.
That's better, she said, sighing happily. Why on earth would you chew tobacco when you could smoke a lovely, delicious Sobrani?
She took another deep drag on her cigarette and spoke again, sounding, if anything, even more bored than before.
Look, I haven't got long, she said, so let's keep it brief. What's so wrong with you that you're skiving off work? Is it serious? Life-threatening? Terminal?
I've got clinical depression, Mummy, I said, all in a rush.
She snorted.
Stuff and nonsense, she said. There's no such thing.
I thought back to what the GP and Raymond had said, and how kind and understanding Bob had been. His sister had depression for years, he told me. I'd had no idea.
Mummy, I said, as defiantly as I dared. I have clinical depression. I'm seeing a counsellor and exploring what happened during my childhood and...
No!
She shouted, so loud and sudden that I took a step back. The next time she spoke, she was quiet, dangerously quiet.
Now you listen to me, Eleanor. Under no circumstances are you to discuss your childhood with anyone, especially not a so-called counsellor. Do you hear me? Don't you dare. I'm warning you, Eleanor. If you start down that path, do you know what will happen? Do you know what I'll do? I'll...
Dare, dare. As always, Mummy was scary. But the thing was, this time, for the first time ever, she'd actually sounded scared, too.
Chapter 31. A few weeks passed, and the sessions with Maria Temple had become a natural part of my routine. It was nice to be out, despite the wind, and I decided to walk instead of taking the bus, enjoying what remained of the sun. There were plenty of other people with the same idea. It felt good to be part of a throng, and I took gentle pleasure in mingling. I dropped 20 pence into the paper cup of a man sitting on the pavement with a very attractive dog. I bought a fudge doughnut from Greg's and ate it as I walked. I smiled at a spectacularly ugly baby who was shaking his fist at me from a garish pushchair. Noticing details, that was good. Tiny slivers of life. They all added up and helped you to feel that you, too, could be a fragment, a little piece of humanity who usefully filled a space, however minuscule. I was pondering this as I waited for the lights to change. Someone tapped me on the arm and I jumped. Eleanor? It was Laura, looking cartoonishly glamorous as usual. I hadn't seen her since Sammy's service. "Oh, hello," I said. "How are you? I'm sorry I didn't manage to speak to you at your father's funeral." She laughed. "Don't worry about it, Eleanor. Ray explained that you were a bit tiddly that day," she said. I felt my face flush and looked down at the pavement. I suppose I had drunk rather a lot of vodka that afternoon. She punched my arm gently. "Oh, don't be daft. That's what funerals are for, aren't they? A wee drink and a catch-up," she said, smiling. I shrugged, still averting my gaze. "Your hair's looking good," she said brightly. I nodded, glanced up into her coal-rimmed eyes. "Several people have remarked upon it, actually," I said, feeling a bit more confident, "which leads me to think that you must have done a very good job." "Och, that's nice to hear," she said. "You can pop back into the salon any time, you know. I'll always try and fit you in, Eleanor." "You were lovely to my dad, so you were." "He was lovely to me," I said. "You were very lucky to have had such a delightful father." Her eyes started to brim, but she blinked the tears away, aided no doubt by the enormous artificial lashes she had glued along her upper lids. The lights at the pedestrian crossing started to flash. "Raymond mentioned how fond of him you both were," she said quietly. She checked her watch. "Oh, God, sorry, I'll need to run, Eleanor. The car's on the meter, and you know what those wardens are like if you go a minute over." I had absolutely no idea what she was talking about, but I let it pass. "I'm seeing Ray this weekend, actually," she said, touching my arm. She smiled. "He's actually quite nice, isn't he? He kind of slipped under my radar at first, but then once you get to know him..." She smiled again. "Anyway, I'll let him know you were asking after him on Saturday, Eleanor," she said. "No need," I said, bristling slightly. "I've recently had luncheon with Raymond, as it happens. What unfortunate timing. I could have let him know that you were asking after him." She stared at me. I didn't know you two were close," she said. "We lunch together weekly," I said. "Ah, right, lunch," she said, looking happier for some reason. "Well, like I said, got to run. Nice seeing you, Eleanor." I raised my hand and bade her farewell. It was incredible how she managed to run so nimbly in those heels. I feared for her ankles. Fortunately, they were rather on the chunky side. Maria Temple was wearing yellow tights today, teamed with purple ankle boots. Yellow tights did not, I noticed, flatter a sporty calf. "I wonder if we might revisit the subject of your mother, Eleanor. Is that perhaps something we could..." "No," I said. More silence. "Fine, fine, no problem. Could you tell me a bit about your father, then? You haven't really mentioned him so far." "I don't have a father," I said. More of that awful silence. It was so annoying, but in the end it actually worked, her refusal to speak. The quiet went on for eons, and in the end I simply couldn't bear it any longer. "Mummy told me she was... she didn't tell me directly when I was a child, but as an adult,
I've come to understand that she was the victim of a... sexual assault, I said, somewhat inelegantly. No response. I don't know his name, and I never met him, I said. She was writing in her notebook and looked up. Did you ever wish you had a father or a father figure in your life, Eleanor? Was it something you missed? I stared at my hands. It was difficult, talking openly about these things, dragging them out for inspection when they'd been perfectly fine as they were, hidden away. You don't miss what you've never had, I said eventually. I'd read that somewhere and it sounded as though it ought to be true. For as long as I can remember, there's only ever been me and her. No one else to play with, to talk to, no shared childhood memories. But I don't suppose that's particularly unusual, and it didn't do me any harm after all. I could feel the impact of these words in my stomach, acidic and bitter, swirling around inside. She was writing in her notebook again and didn't look up. Did your mother ever talk about the assault? Did she know her assailant? I stated quite clearly on the first day I came here that I didn't want to talk about her, I said. She spoke gently. Of course, don't worry, we won't talk about her, Eleanor, not if you don't want to. I'm just asking in the context of your father, trying to find out more about him, your feelings about him, that's all. I thought about it. I don't really have any feelings about him, Maria. Did you ever consider trying to find him? She said. A rapist? I shouldn't have thought so, I said. A daughter's relationship with her father can sometimes influence her subsequent relationships with men. Do you have any thoughts about that, Eleanor? I pondered. Well, I said, Mummy wasn't particularly keen on men, but then she wasn't keen on anyone, really. She thought most people were unsuitable for us, regardless of their gender. What do you mean? Maria said. Here we were, talking about Mummy, after I'd expressly forbidden it. However, I found, much to my surprise, that I was actually starting to enjoy holding court like this, having Dr. Temple's undivided attention. Perhaps it was the lack of eye contact. It felt relaxing, almost as though I was talking to myself. The thing is, I said, she only wanted us to socialize with people who were nice, people who were proper. That was something she talked about a lot. She always insisted that we spoke politely, behaved with decorum. She made us practice elocution, at least an hour a day. She had, well, let's just say she had quite direct methods of correcting us when we said the wrong thing, did the wrong thing, which was pretty much all the time. Maria nodded, indicated that I should go on. She said that we deserved the best of everything, and that even in straitened circumstances, we should always conduct ourselves properly. It was almost as though she thought we were some kind of displaced royalty, you know, the family of a deposed czar or an overthrown monarch or something. I tried so hard, but I never managed to look and behave the way she thought I should, to behave appropriately. That made her very unhappy and very angry. Mind you, it wasn't just me. No one was ever good enough. She was always telling us we had to be on the lookout for someone who was good enough. I shook my head. I suppose that's how I ended up here, I said, trying to find someone like that and then getting confused and making a giant mess of everything. I realized that my whole body was shaking like a wet dog on a cold morning. Maria looked up. Let's move on for now, she said gently. Do you want to tell me something about what happened after you and your mother parted company? About your experience of the care system? What was that like? I shrugged. Being fostered was fine. Being in residential care was fine. No one abused me. I had food and drink, clean clothes and a roof over my head. I went to school every day until I was 17 and then I went to university. Can't really complain about any of it. Maria spoke very gently. What about your other needs, Eleanor? I'm not sure I'm quite following you, Maria, I said, puzzled. Humans have a range of needs that we need to have met, Eleanor, in order to be happy and healthy individuals. You've described how your basic physical needs, warmth, food, shelter, were taken care of.
But what about your emotional needs?
I was completely taken aback.
But I don't have any emotional needs, I said.
Neither of us spoke for a while. Eventually she cleared her throat.
Everyone does, Eleanor. All of us. And especially young children need to know that we're loved, valued, accepted.